Perhaps this scientific method could be extended to other fields of learning. Perhaps I could lead the way to a new age. An age of rebirth. A renaissance. Nah.
Hello, my name is Nick Ebden, and you are listening to the Hypnosis Discussion Network podcast. Thanks for joining us again on the podcast. This week, I am exceptionally pleased to have someone who I greatly admire. I said I'd mention it, so I will mention it. He was a little beacon of light for me in my own personal journey this year. I hate that expression, sorry, journey. He is one of the more outspoken critics of what I agree are some of the more grubby and embarrassing elements within the therapy and NLP communities. He runs a private practice in West Sussex. He has a specialist interest in schizophrenia and anxiety. I'm very pleased to welcome Andrew Austin. Now, for anyone who doesn't know Andrew Austin, his work's been heavily influenced by R.D. Lang, Charles Faulkner, Gregory Bateson, and Thomas Szasz. Is that pronounced right, Andrew?
I think so. I never met Thomas Szasz. I've always said Szasz. He might pronounce it differently.
Good. That would do me then, if it's good enough for you. He's developed two bodies of work, Integral Eye Movement Therapy, IEMT, and Metaphors of Movement. Both have become recognised modalities and are listed in the Sage Encyclopedia of Counselling and Psychotherapy. As I said before, he's a welcome and outspoken critic of the narcissism and lack of professionalism within the therapeutic profession, especially the NLP community, which he describes as rotten to the core. He's also the author of The Rainbow Machine, a book that I read quite a few years ago. I'm not making you sound old, but it wasn't many years ago. Hopefully he's going to tell us about The Rainbow Machine, IEMT, Metaphors Movement, and so much more. And what I really want to pick his brains about today is how he sees the state of the therapeutic community and NLP, because I'm a real admirer of Andrew's written work, the videos that he puts out, and sometimes he does come across as that lone voice of reason, talking about some of the horror and absolute poor lack of professionalism within the profession. If you can hear any yelping in the background, it's a puppy that doesn't want to be left alone. I've asked the kids to look after Andrew. I'm sorry, they're not up to doing the job at the moment, so you might hear me shout at some point. But Andrew, it's an absolute personal pleasure of mine to welcome you onto the podcast.
Thank you, Nick, and thanks for bigging me up. I'll see if I can live up to expectation. We'll see what happens.
Right. So one of the things I touched on, and one of the things that I'm a huge fan of, there's many, but it is the fact that you have, on many instances, been a lone voice of reason against what I consider the nefarious and terrible elements of the profession. Can you just expand on that a little bit for anyone who doesn't know some of your work?
All right, so honestly, we've got more therapists, coaches, practitioners of every alphabet therapy, whether it's NLP, EMDR, IMT, CBT, TFT, EFT, all the alphabet therapies. Every year, just think, in the UK alone, how many hundreds, if not thousands, of people are certifying and qualifying every year? Now, if we replicate that worldwide, we also have, meanwhile, in psychiatry, which is the more sort of orthodoxy end, we have better, more research taking place all the time. Universities are constantly doing research. There's more and more PhDs every year. We have better educational systems. We have better communication systems going on. So there's more information around psychology and therapy. And look at the state of the world. Look at the state of the average teenager. Look at the state of the average adult. Mental health rates should be perfect by now, because I think everyone is so psychoeducated into absolutely everything there is to do about feelings, mental well-being, all that kind of stuff. And yet people seem to be worse than ever. I'm certainly busier than ever. Now, in theory, I should not be able to get any employment. I should not have any clients. None of us should have. And yet still things are getting worse and worse and worse. Now, I know correlation isn't causation, but the question I have is, are we all doing something wrong? Is all this psychoeducation that is being pumped into culture and community and society, where now everyone is so aware of mental health, And I've just got to say, on that note, when I was younger, when I was working in the orthodoxy system, mental health meant things like real organic disease, whether we're talking from deterioration disorders such as Alzheimer's, dementia, we're talking about things like the schizophrenias, of which is affecting at least 1% of the population, bipolar, not modern day TikTok bipolar. I'm talking real bipolar, when people are needing to be hospitalized and institutionalized for periods of time for their own well-being. Those were things that were mental health. Now it's whether you feel comfortable in your body and whether you have an emotion. And now we all have to sit around and talk about that, create a care plan pathway and all sorts of other stuff and make referrals and talk about safeguarding around every tiny little flick in an otherwise beautiful day. And I think what we have created is a population that is lacking any form of resource, any form of sustainability and self, what's the word, resilience. That's the word I'm looking for. People are so unresilient, it blows my mind. And now we have, no, but then all suffering's relative. You know, what you might think of is not, oh, for goodness sake. Objectivity is no longer permitted. And now everything is seen to be subjective. So that's basically where I'm coming from.
Yeah, I just, funnily enough, I just finished a book. I think it was your recommendation. If it wasn't your recommendation, it was a recommendation from one of the members of one of your groups on Facebook, and Bad Therapy, which pretty much...
Abigail Schreier.
Yeah, but pretty much covers... for those who don't know, I think she was a Wall Street Journal journalist. I think she is an academic in her own right as well, right? And she basically pretty much covers what you've said. I don't know if you listened to the Gary Turner conversation that I had.
I haven't yet.
I don't know if you're one of the 11 listeners who have so far, but he, funny enough, he bigs you up as well. We had a bit of an Andrew Austin love.
I pay him. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. You can't threaten him, so you have to pay him. And he was saying as well during that conversation, and it's a conversation we've had offline together, him and I, is that you have a lot of people now coming to you with therapy, that for therapy, for coaching or whatever it is, and what they actually need is, and again, this is touched on that Bad Therapy book, and I know you've touched on it in the past, is just someone suggesting a strategy to them. It doesn't involve taking their money. It just involves another perspective, or a big slap in the face of reality,
yeah,
as well. And we have a lot of people call us that we actually don't follow through and become clients, because the right thing to do is be honest with them.
But here's the thing. So my little rant at the beginning there. Now, Abigail Schreier, her book about, as you mentioned, Bad Therapy, she articulates it far better than I do. But here's the thing we now have to consider. So we have this glut, this huge rise in mental distress being reported across the board. Is this a mental health crisis? Now, people say there isn't such a thing as a mental health crisis. Things are better than ever. And then other people will say, well, clearly you only have to look at the state of young people, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the question I have now is, so if I'm now saying that everything now is classified as mental health, so the slight glimmer in a person's day renders them requiring some kind of counseling support, validation, affirmation, whatever it is. Is their suffering invalid? Is what they're experiencing actually real, or can we just tell them to knock it off? Now, the people that come and see me, it's very, very real. And I suspect the people that come and see other therapists and coaches too, the suffering they're experiencing is very, very real. So I'm not suggesting that countrywide, worldwide now, everyone's imagining disorders and dissatisfaction, mental distress. They're making it up. What I'm saying is we've created a paradigm that is making people ill. We are making a paradigm that is rendering people, we're incapacitating resilience. We're incapacitating, most of all, adaptability to an ever-changing world. And what we've actually rendered people is we've made them miserable, and their misery is real. So now we as a profession, for all the alphabet therapies, psychiatry, psychology, and all the branches of mental well-being, have created a paradigm of creating distress, and now we can mop it up and profit. That's what the industry has done. We now have people talk about big pharma, and big pharma's bad if you're on the fringes of the orthodoxy. What about big therapy? Because big therapy has taken over, and it's taken over culture, it's taken over society, it's even taken over the language. And the policing of language is now a result of big therapy. And now people are frightened to be honest. Because if people are honest about what they see in their senses, they might offend. And if they offend, they might be subject to disciplinary censorship. They might have the Twitter hate mob go after them. There's all sorts of consequences now about telling the truth. And truth-telling now is hugely problematic. Having an opinion is really dangerous. And this is all the results of therapy that I can see.
And where do you think that comes? Do you think it originated from a political ideology?
Nope, I don't think there's any one thing driving it apart from individuals thinking, I know what I can do for my living. I can better myself. Do you remember back in the 80s and 90s, everyone went to do it when basically, how can I improve my life? I want more satisfaction in life. I'm going to go to adult education evening classes and do a counseling course. And then in the night into the 90s, everyone was doing counseling courses. And remember aromatherapy, when everyone was being an aromatherapist, that was the big trend. Then as things start to change, NLP starts to come in, becomes very fashionable, very trendy, and then all the spin-offs from that. Then next thing you know, everyone's bettering themselves by doing personal development courses. And of course, the internet facilitates that. So what we have are individuals like you and I, because we're not exempt from this. By this podcast, by my YouTube channel, by my websites, my courses, and all those other people that we know and we like and respect, we're all contributing to that. Why? Because we are creating our own personal success. We're carving out our niche in life. We're trying to better ourselves, and we market ourselves. Now, that replicated by several tens of thousands of people across the country constantly starts to feed into the culture. Meanwhile, you have people in education who are then going, well, I'm going to go off and do that particular course because that looks interesting. You have people in universities doing the same thing. You'll have people in hospitals who are always, staff are always doing additional courses. And so as more and more people are selling these courses, more and more people are taking them up, it starts a social movement. And it's all created by individuals creating their own success, pushing their own profits, their own websites, pushing for their own recruitment of clients, competing with each other. And with competition, people are always slightly escalating just a little bit more. We've done it. We are all responsible for it.
Absolutely. And do you know what? I absolutely have been guilty of it myself. You know, I've been seduced by and succumbed to the idea of getting something as quick as possible. You know, that is a cultural thing of this time. And so when I got into this because I had a positive experience from cognitive behavioral therapy and hypnosis and NLP. And then I wanted some of that. But then I wanted some of that, and I wanted some of that quickly. And then I wanted I wanted to be teaching it quickly. And then I wanted to be better than the person next to me. And I think if you have a shred of integrity, as you do this and find yourself in it, and this was my personal experience, it becomes a permanent itch that you have over yourself that is just wrong. So I've ended up turning my back on the training and the certification side back then. I do intend to do it again, but like a lot of things, now I'm going to wait until I'm ready that I can deliver something because I enjoy doing it. But the quality of the material I give isn't going to be any different from anything else and probably be lesser than others. So that's one of my plans. But with working with people as well, one of the things which I think you touch on so eloquently is you use an expression which I've totally nicked and I've probably used it to death since. It's the commoditization of...
Yeah.
Of mental health, that was the expression I was looking for, and so what I found myself doing, which I found distasteful, not only was I fast tracking and compromising quality in what I was doing and giving, but to get your clients, you have to kind of tell everyone, you've either got to be patient and have word of mouth and build up a reputation for actually making people better, and no one wants to do that, or you have to tell people that they're broken a little bit.
Right. There is no aspect of human suffering that can't be commodified. in some capacity. And somebody sent me yesterday a link to a deliberate self-harm rescue kit. And these were first aid kits that you can give to your teenager who has deliberate self-harm issues. And it's like, is there nothing? Is there nothing that can't be commodified and profited from? Now, of course, it's all done very nicely. And I have no doubt the people who set up that little business, they probably had someone in their life who was self-harming and they thought, what can we do? Hmm. Well, profit from it, obviously. Yeah. But no, we want to help others. And so now we have this very uneasy tension between requiring payment for what we do and wanting to help people. And the one thing I know, because I've experienced this myself, when the money starts coming in and the money's good money, that starts to change people's opinions quite a lot. And the old thing was the kind of clients that people want, and I can't remember the acronym for it now, for the life of me, can't remember it, which are basically people want affluent, articulate, educated, highly verbal, and basically not very unwell, with lots of disposable income clients. No one wants the drunk schizophrenic who's homeless. And when I think about mental health, I'm thinking about what I regard as the shit end of life. The people who are basically, the pronoun police are out in force now, governing mental well-being and this sort of the explosion now of people's the identity politics and so forth. And we have completely eliminated schizophrenia from the narrative of mental health. We've completely eliminated real old school bipolar from the narrative these days. It's all been hijacked by all these pseudo diagnostics, and everyone's neurodivergent, everyone's ADHD these days and so forth. Yet those conditions really exist. The people who actually have the real condition, as opposed to what I call the TikTok version, really suffer. Now, they've been eliminated from the equation. And the healthcare services that service those individuals are now overwhelmed with referrals for stuff that is actually more sort of emotional well-being rather than mental illness. But the same services get those. They've been scrubbed from the narrative. How many coaches and therapists do we know that actually work with people at the shit end of life? The paranoid schizophrenic who is continuously moving between temporary accommodations. The person who's bipolar, who's constantly blowing all family finances when they're on the upswing and so forth. These are not the ones we want to work with. And so now what's also happened is the coaches are working with people who are saying they've got these diagnostics, but they're articulate, affluent, good-looking, they've got nice skin, they've got a high disposable income. But actually, those diagnostics aren't necessarily the same. And so this is the other area that I'm really critical, is that the constant promoting of self-success by every individual is replicated across the board. What that's doing is watering down what reference points we're actually talking about when we talk about mental health. So when I talk about mental health, I'm talking about people with, say, psychotic illnesses, people who have not some identity issues. And when we talk about self-harm, they have really, really gone for it. And we are talking people who have disfigured themselves the rest of their lives. That scale of issue, no one wants to work with them. And when somebody does work with them, it seems to become sort of a core celebra for them to then boast about forevermore. Well, that's what the work is. As far as I'm concerned, where I've come from, that's what the work is. That's the norm when it comes to mental health. But now it just seems to be what I call cosmetic therapy. And everything's been commodified.
I think the counter side to that is that maybe that's a good thing, especially with the hypnosis community, where you don't actually want them. You want them running away from serious issues because they're ill-equipped. They're not educated.
We want them better trained with a higher... Now, and forgive me those listening, the three or four people who are actually going to listen to this podcast. I don't want hypnotists being inadequate, unable to deal with those conditions. I would rather they pull their finger out, engage a brain cell, and start working harder. But they don't, because people want to get paid for talking, and they want to get paid handsomely for talking. And you'll see it on the website. I'm fully insured, because apparently their talking is so fucking dangerous. They've got to have insurance and boast about it. These are essentially, this is what does somebody do when they don't want to work anymore? They become a coach, a therapist, a practitioner. Mm. and they go and do a 2-day course, 4-day course. Now, I'm partly guilty of this myself. I won't, you know, I'll take any criticism that comes my way about this. But what people will do is they then grab a certificate and then announce themselves to be the practitioner, and off they go. But that's where it stops. How many people are getting themselves hospital placements where they're volunteering on a unit somewhere? How many people are going to go and get part-time work with the pastoral counseling service and the support groups that run constantly in the community centers and downtown? How many people will go into the drunk tanks, the refuges, all these different places where, unfortunately, the people at the shit end of life go and actually volunteer their time to learn and study and interface with the staff that work there and learn more stuff? They don't. They don't. Mm. Probably about 1 in 1,000 will actually make that effort. But what they do want to do is have a nice, shiny website and then portray themselves as an expert.
Yep. Oh, do you know what? In my first incarnation of working with people, I found that I had a problem. Right, so from my own personal perspective, I had a problem because I had other income streams. I was, on the scale of things, by any parameter, wealthy and well off, and I still had a healthy income. So I to try and put a bit back and sleep better at night, I started doing charity work or working with, it was actually abused women, really. And it was when they was going through the NHS or the other support groups that they just weren't resonating with a certain little small group of women who perhaps needed a bit of more direct talk or needed a man's perspective, which again is almost not allowed these days. And I found that was not only the most rewarding work, but I learned the most from it. I learned most about people because these are people with real issues. What happened, though, was then it cocked up my business model because I then started helping desperate people. And I think I'm not the only person that's been there. I had the problem of charging for the real issues and happy to charge for the superficial ones, if that makes sense.
Right.
And that's why I can sit objectively and give people advice about running a business. Don't ask me to run a hypnotherapy business because I am the worst example of it. What I'm trying to do now,
right? And here is the uneasy tension. Mm. This is the uneasy tension that exists between wanting to help people and wanting to have an income, and it is a problem. It's one of those things that how does a practitioner resolve that? Where do they, because we still have to pay bills and the cost of living these days is horrendous. And this is the problem we have, is that how do we resolve this? And I don't have an answer for anybody, that having more than one income stream is probably the best I could suggest, but it's down to each individual to resolve. But at the same time, of course, if somebody wants to charge, say, £1,000 an hour for their work because they think they're worth that, and there are people stupid enough to pay it, then they're made for each other. Then so be it. I'm not going to take that away from anybody. But they're still all individually contributing to this cultural mindset, the pathologization of everyday life, where now everything is basically, your life isn't good enough. Your life can be improved by my therapy. Your life can be improved with my coaching. You can achieve more. You can do more. You should never be satisfied. You should never settle. And God forbid you find yourself in a comfort zone. I mean, what therapists have about comfort zones? I mean, my God, what is wrong with these people? Most people want a comfort zone. They don't want to step outside of it every single day to try and be a high achiever, just like TikTok or whatever.
It's crazy, though. I mean, you mentioned like the pricing points. So even for me, if I'm working with someone up in the city, It's that mentality that if I said I'd do it for 50 quid an hour, they wouldn't come to me. But I want to help the person down the road at 50 quid an hour.
Yeah.
But then I can't have two different prices. But ultimately, going back to the beginning of the conversation, will probably turn into a practical application of strategies to make your life better rather than magic therapy. So it's the system is absolutely broken. And as you say, you've got people who are just openly exploiting it, piling into it. And the ones that, the Hypnosis Discussion Network group, the Facebook group, a lot of people don't like it, and a lot of trainers stay out of it because they get scrutinized in it. But they all want to make these little echo chambers, and they make these little minions and these little Kool-Aiders that then go and dilute the quality of therapy again. And that's half of the reason for the podcast and the group, to challenge just how shit it is at the moment.
Right. Well, how can you make the most money as a therapist? Easy. Create more therapists. I can give you the magic formula to I'm going to teach you to be a therapist. And it's like the people who talk about get rich quick, and I will teach you the proven 7-step system to make £1 million. Well, ultimately what it's going to come down to is you also now start selling a 7-step system on how to make £1 million. And so there's a never-ending pyramid. And it's the old thing of coaching, who coaches coach coaches to coach coaches to coach more coaches. Does anyone ever go and see a fucking life coach if they're not a life coach themselves in training? And so it's this never-ending pyramid that never actually has a target audience, and it's therapy for therapy's sake. And the people I think I pick on the most, and I've had a few hit jobs done on me recently, which I must admit I did find quite amusing, the effort they had gone to, which is this, which is you can be anything you want to be. Come and do my NLP training, whatever alphabet therapy training, and you too can be anything that you want to be. And what I started saying to them was, okay, so you could be anything you want to be, and you settled for being a fucking trainer.
Well,
Because
from
apparently
what
that's the highest of the high. That's the ultimate high status position, is to be a trainer.
it's really funny going back to the expression commoditization. Obviously, my background is in commodity trading, so. So you'll see these therapists and life coaches selling, be another trainer, be a coach, be a trainer, and then you can then do the trainer, and boom, and we're building a nice pyramid scheme. And you see it in the trading community as well. I ask exactly the same question. If you're so good at trading, why the fuck are you teaching other people
There you go.
how to trade?
Why create
If,
competition for
but
yourself?
what a weight where. I mean, unless you're that good where you can actually move a market and you're never going to have that many clients or students, you're actually telling people you're not good at trading by doing that. And unfortunately, and this is something Gary and I have spoken about, and he's referred people to me too, and it's ended in a rather abrupt phone call. You've been sold a fucking bum. You're not ever going to be a good trader by picking an off-the-shelf way to trade and think it's going to work. I'm sorry, the numbers game. Professional traders in the hedge fund community, like there's a 90% failure, and these are guys that have been plucked from the industry themselves. What makes you think that this guy with big white veneers gurning at you on a YouTube video is going to teach you anything that 20 years of experience can't teach people? And I think it's exactly the same with the therapy community. These people, and like I say, I've been guilty of it a little bit in the past in a rush to become a hypnotist or a hypnotherapist. They get seduced by the it's that easy. And do you know what? If people are going to do that, at least do it with some integrity and honesty. Now, I know that you say you've had a few hatchet jobs. I've been involved with behind the scene hatchet jobs as well. With some of the more nefarious characters in the NLP and the therapy community. And unfortunately, the problem with the industry is because everyone's a little guilty, very few people call people out. And that is why I love what you're prepared to do. Not only do you have actually more credentials, but your training is there's actually bodies and bodies of research behind it. There's multi inferences that you're open to sharing and can talk about in depth. But you and that totally puts you in contrast to the people that we don't like. I mean, there's one name that springs to mind. And we've been openly talking about, but the fact of the
Oh,
matter
if we talk
is,
about Kevin Lay, I'm more than happy to name Kevin Lay.
okay, cool,
Just, can I
I
just
am
say
as well.
for
Just make
something for the record, you see, well, here's one of the things. there's an issue. There's an issue about naming and shaming people and outing people and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, when people are reluctant to say something, it's because they haven't got evidence. They might suspect, they might have a strong feeling, they might have heard other people say something, but actually to their own direct senses, they have no direct evidence for themselves. Now, I'm more than happy to name Kevin Lay. He's a great example of an individual who focused on status without actual experience. Mm-hmm. And so if you look on his website, he's got, here are my qualifications, and he's got 10,000 certificates. He's told stories about his exploits with the SAS and the Special Forces and, you know, close protection, royal protection, adventures overseas, being tortured, parachuting in, being a sniper for Special Forces, working for foreign militaries. Just relentless. Now, we have to question how much of that is true. For one man, he's done a lot.
Mm.
Now, the reason I was quite happy to name him is because I started seeing people coming to me reporting that they were afraid because of what they had happened, what they had experienced. So I started looking a bit deeper, and I was able to find very, very quickly direct evidence that contradicted a lot of the stuff that was claimed. And so I posted publicly that data. What fascinates me about it is that the amount of reaction I had and messages and emails that came to me criticizing me for doing it, because you shouldn't name one of your own. What? So basically, when we see like governmental cover-ups, police cover-ups of one of their own, people are rightly outraged about it. There's the issue about the post office that's very much in the news at the moment, and we can see what took place there, and people are rightly outraged about it. And here are custodians of mental health, custodians of well-being, custodians of humanity, that's what therapists essentially are, who are willing to support a cover-up. But not only that, I got quite a few messages, and I have to say they were all from women. None of them came from men, which was basically saying, well, everyone lies a little bit, so what does it matter? Wow. That's all I can say.
Wow.
It's absolute wow that people, and this is Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper. He was a record holder for the number of women who had offered marriage proposals to him while he was in prison. Well, he's still in prison. I don't know if he's still alive. But it's amazing to me how people will support the narcissist who is actively deceiving. And do you know why people are quite happy? Because they aspire to it themselves.
Yeah.
People admire the guts and the sheer conceitedness of the man to be able to say all that stuff and get to the positions he got to, because he lied his way pretty much to the top and did it brilliantly. And people admire that. Because people boast a little bit and lie a little bit in their own marketing and self-reference.
Yeah. No, I do think there's an admiration for the fact that he's got away with it, and they wish they could. I also think as well that there's a huge element of, especially people that have trained under them, or gone to them for therapy, that there's some cognitive dissonance going on, that they just can't accept that the guy is a complete and utter fraud. You know, I sat in a training. The first time I met him in person, I was invited to a training and from another person that we could probably have a conversation about. And I sat and observed him, and he deliberately set out to mislead, you know.
Right. There's something else I want to throw in.
Engineering background. Well, if you actually follow his own, well, it depends what one you pick, but own biographies, his engineering finished at the age of 16,
right,
because he was handpicked by
okay,
the Special
but
Forces.
Can I just throw something else in here? Because these individuals, and Kevin is a good example, because he's I think he's the highest profile. He's got the most data that is easily accessible to him.
Mm-hmm.
The lies are so numerous and so easily challenged, so easily challenged with evidence. He did not get there by himself.
No.
He didn't get to be up in the higher echelons of whatever alphabet therapy communities he was rubbing shoulders with on his own. He got there with collusion by everyone else. And for the simple reason, no one bothered to check. And this is the issue I have. So my background, I started off as a nurse. I was a general nurse working in hospitals. Everyone gets checked. You have ID. Your references are checked. Your CV is checked. Your qualifications are verified. Checks take place. When it comes to mental health that's outside of psychiatry, no one bothers to check. How did Kevin get to where he wanted to be? Because people wanted in on some of the action that they potentially, by being his mate, by working with him and rubbing shoulders with him, maybe they get that royal connection. Maybe they get to work with those celebrities. And he did work with some celebrities because people believed him and no one bothered to check. Now he's got those connections going on. They now give some veracity to the claims he makes. Now more people want in. And so you'll see it right from the beginning where the person has to take the photograph next to the celebrity trainer and post it on their website and post it on their Facebook page. They list out all the certifications they've done. Status marketing is what drives the mindset. Mm-hmm. I will be successful. I will make the income if I can impress people with my status. And status relies on other people. So the more you can rub shoulders with people with high status. And so the whole field, this is why I say it's rotten to its core. The whole field is run by narcissists who lie and lie and lie. And people want in on the action and they're willing to overlook the lies if it favors them. And they will continue to do that. And it will continue to happen. And then when someone like myself comes along, and I know I'm not the only one, then we ruin the party. And people go, well, hey, he's not talking about me. Well, maybe I am. Maybe I am. Yeah. If that person who's thinking that is doing these same behaviors, then I certainly am. Obviously, the listeners here won't be those people. Of course they won't be. And this is the problem. People are obsessed of status over efficacy and reality. And this is why things have got so rotten. Where now, being a trainer, and then you're a master trainer, then you're a master trainer elite, this never-ending craving for status.
Do you know what, though? What I find amazing is, I can understand that. Again, you know, I think people have to be honest. I'll be honest. When I first got qualified, I had a picture with Dwight Damon, the president of the NGH or whatever it was.
I don't know.
Do you know what? I thought it was a knee up, right?
Yeah.
Exactly like you're saying. But at some point, if you genuinely want to help people, and you genuinely want to do the right thing about people, you have to ask yourself this question, and this is what I do ask people, and they don't like it, is that if you think for some reason, and it might be because you spent 7 days in the classroom and got a certificate, or you're worldly, or you're this, or you're that, that you have got something about you that you can help someone, how can you not, when you're sitting in a training room, spot an idiot from a mile away, spot a bullshitter from a mile away? I mean, like I said, Kevin's so obvious. Like I said, within 5 minutes of being in his company, I knew the bloke was full of shit. You know, it didn't, nothing added up. And I can't believe that I'm the only one sat in that room thinking.
Right. But there's another thing going on as well. We have to look at people's motivations for why they go to trainings and why people do stuff. So you've got two major driving forces in people, which is basically, am I driven by accomplishment or am I driven by social connection? Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of people are driven by social connection. There's definitely people on the more sort of upper class, higher echelons, higher income, more narcissistic end are much more driven by accomplishment. Nice people are more driven by social connection. Now, there's both of those things going on in different ratios of people. When people go to a training room, these trainers build community. You only have to look at the languaging of it. You now take on an identity mantle. I am a such and such practitioner now. And I'm part of, say, if we look at the Bandler-Grinder divide, I'm part of the Bandler school. I'm part of the Grinder school. I do tapping. I do energy medicine. Energy medicine, for fuck's sake. I do energy medicine. I trained with Gary, or I trained with whoever the TFT guy was. I forget his name. So we've got all these divisions, but those divisions are very important to the scene. They're not examples of how people necessarily don't carry on in a business relationship with each other. The divisions actually define the scene, because now they define the tribes. And as long as I'm of this tribe and not that tribe, and as long as they define themselves as that tribe and not this tribe, we now have a rivalry. We now have in-group and out-group psychology. And now we have social cohesion within our community. And the trainers within that then are is kind of loosely part of a hierarchy which doesn't really exist apart from in their imaginations, where I trained with such and such who trained with such and such. So there's a lineage, you know, that kind of stuff. You see the same thing in martial arts. Everyone trained with somebody who has a lineage to Bruce Lee, you know, that kind of bollocks. And you've got all these different factions as well, and who's fake and who's genuine, all that kind of stuff. This is how communities work across any definition of communities. Therapists are exactly the same. So when they're a part of a group and they've paid good money, I mean, let's face it, some of these are four figures. I've seen people pay five figures for trainings or two trainers. They've now bought in, and they've often had to travel. They've often had to stay in hotels, all that kind of stuff. What are they doing in the evening? They're hanging out with other people of the course. Mm-hmm. And there's all these little things start to go building the psychology of the community and the loyalty people have to that. So even after people like Kevin are widely exposed, you still see people advertising. And I know doctors, and I wrote to these doctors individually, and my God, did I get some very interesting replies. Nothing favorable. I wrote to some of the doctors who are still listing on their websites, they're GPs who are also doing hypnotherapy, who trained with Kevin, and they proudly still display those affiliations and certifications. Why? Because to go against the community, to commit that heresy, to commit apostasy, is one of the greatest taboos inside human psychology. To speak out against your own community is to be a traitor, is to be a snitch. And that is one of the worst. We used to execute people for that. We used to banish people from the community, which would be a death sentence. It was the worst thing in human psychology a person can do. So everyone keeps their mouth shut. And they continue to show affiliation. You'll see it in wars where who's classic thing, complete subject change, paradigm change. But if Russia invades across Europe, how many people want to fight for Britain, to fight for our government? How many young people have a sufficient investment because of the fragmentation that's taken place?
Yeah.
Because we haven't built community with young people. Mm. People are disconnected from community. This is one of the problems. It's a very, very powerful force. But people will still fight for their government and a cause and go to war rather than refuse, even if they don't believe in the government, they don't believe in the war, and they don't believe in the cause they're fighting for. People will still do that. That is how powerful that is. It doesn't matter who we are the good guys. Even if we've got that funny little insignia on our dark uniforms as we march in goose step, we're still the good guys.
Yeah, and do you know what? I think that's what a lot of people tell themselves, we're the good guys. And when I've challenged them, you know, on a one-to-one, why are you still endorsing that? Why are you doing this? There's that sort of shruggy sort of, well, yeah, but I don't use it. I don't, you know, or this, that, and the other. One of the other, I won't mention any names, but someone who runs for over the years has been a fairly big training school, and they run their own association, this, that, and the other. I went to one of their offshoot trainings, the first one was online, and even though the research behind it was a little sketchy, it was a kind of a useful tool, albeit a variation of what people were already doing. He then added levels to it. And I was on the second level, and it was an in-person training. And I literally sat there for, I think it was 2 days, thinking, what the fuck is this? This is so detached from what the first thing was that you're just exploiting the success of the first thing to create a training. And when I was talking to people in person, they all said the same thing. And yet, come Monday morning, they were gushing about it.
Yep.
And I thought, wow, like maybe it is truly lost. But they were literally gushing.
They will, because they bought into it, and they're now part of that community.
Even though that on an individual level, they're telling me they don't know what the guy's talking about.
Yeah.
And other stuff.
There's other factors as well that we have to bear in mind, is that the majority of people, especially people on the soft skills, so people in the people helping field, as opposed to people in the STEM sciences, that kind of stuff, are much more likely to be community based. So they're much more about social connection over accomplishment. What they're also going to be very high in is agreeableness. So individuals like myself, and I suspect yourself and the people we know are also on the other end of the spectrum, are much more willing to be highly disagreeable, are much more likely to break social connection. More, I mean, a thing in my psychology, I would rather be alone on my own in a tent than stuck in a community of people I don't like. But a lot of people, that would be the most terrifying thing they could imagine. The loss of social connection is a very powerful force for people. And so once we now have a there's a bias in the sampling of who becomes a therapist, much more likely to be people orientated, community orientated, and very high in expressed agreeableness. And so now these are now the people who will take that stuff and move to finding agreement. See, you and I move to look for criticism. They don't do that. They're nice people. People like them. People don't necessarily like us because we're disagreeable, and we in a conversation are freely disagree with the other person, even if they're a friend. Most people don't do that. Most people always seek agreement. Whereas I don't have the need for that. And unfortunately, when you now have a group of those people and they've paid money, they got the buy-in, they will start to replicate the very thing that is being taught to them.
I think culturally, being agreeable, you've touched on some of the topics already. It pays to be agreeable. It pays not to speak out. It
Does.
pays not to challenge. I think, obviously, what I didn't mention in your introduction was your history in nursing, and you actually have a medical background. So you need a level of objectivity to do your to do you need to question, and you need to have yourself questioned as well. From a trading perspective, I need to do that as well. I need people to tell me where I'm going wrong. I need to question everything, not just follow what suits. And I think so plus as well, there's a big part of your personality. I love the fact that you are disagreeable, because it's the disagreeable people that point out that the emperor has no clothes.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a bit of background. I think it's we've needed to be objective. We've needed to critique ourselves, to hold ourselves to a certain standard and others to a standard as well.
There's something else I think people can learn from the way medical people, nursing people are trained in hospitals. This is much more on the medical side. So this wasn't something that I did as part of training, but it's something I was well aware of in some of the departments I worked in. So quite often a consultant or teams of consultants will put together an adversarial system in terms of what they call differential diagnosis. So there'll be case study conferences where you have different teams coming in and different level all the different levels of hierarchies. And basically to debate and discuss both the diagnostics on an individual. This is very common in places like neurology, where differential diagnosis is can be very challenging because of the huge scope of what actually could be going on for an individual. And so differential diagnosis will be debated, and then an agreement will be settled upon. Now, those meetings can be quite adversarial. Now, quite often, the consultants will now set the fifth-year medical students to find an alternative diagnostic, disprove what has been arrived at, and argue for it. And they now have to present that back to the whole team. And so now you have some very nervous fifth-year students to all of their most senior consultants, who are the most experienced people that you're ever going to meet in your life in this kind of field. And they now have to tell them why they're wrong. And the consultants aren't going to just sit there and listen. They will argue with them every tiny detail. That is so important. Because now what we have are people who are willing and have to, by definition, be critical of their very own work and actually really consider it. What we end up with in the alphabet therapies is people go, well, when I get someone with depression, I just use tapping and that fixes everything. When I get someone with trauma, I just use the fast phobia cure and that fixes trauma. Literally, that's it. And they don't even know who they're talking about. They don't even know the psychopathologies going on with the particular individuals they're recommending these techniques for. And they're not willing to consider that there might be plenty of differential pathologies going on, psychopathologies going on, but also a whole array of approaches that might be superior. But most importantly, they never consider, what is my methodology actually producing inside the person? Okay, it pays my bills. It makes me feel validated by the community that I bought into. But is the output of what I'm doing making the world a better place? Is it, how is it affecting these individuals? So if we look in the education system, the well-meaning, again, highly agreeable, people who move to agreement, people who value social connection over accomplishment, there's a rainbow. I mean, I'm massively overgeneralizing, so forgive me for the overgeneralizing. There's a rainbow flag in every school, and every child is allowed to have a pronoun badge, whatever form that actually takes in reality. By creating that paradigm, this is love over judgment. This is affirming identity over being critical and invalidation. This is gender-affirming care. This is validation. It sounds lovely. It sounds loving. It sounds positive, and it is well-intended. I don't believe many people are doing this negatively intended. But now look at the consequences that has in the real world and what that paradigm now creates in terms of social confusion amongst the children. And we've seen this week, we've seen the government report that's come out. I know there's criticisms of that. This is the thing therapists aren't thinking about. By being part of this paradigm and putting stuff out there, what impact is this now having? What are we actually creating? Because a lot of people are actually focused on self-interest. In the frame of being agreeable, seeking social connection, and trying to make, you know, be a good person. Because let's face it, most therapists are positively intended, even if they're useless, even if they're actually detrimental to their client groups. They're well-intended, and they intend to be nice people. But they're not, they don't have the intellectual capacity. They don't, and I mean that for real. I'm not saying that like, I shouldn't insult people. They don't have the intellectual capacity because they haven't been taught to actually think about the bigger picture. What are the consequences of what we're doing? What are the alternatives to what we're doing? People buy into a thing and they stay there, and then they stick with it. And then for them, that's the universe. That's the whole reality.
Yeah, no, I absolutely, you know, you put it better than I, but, you know, going back to someone like a lay, you know, depression, someone comes to him presenting with severe depression, and he's telling you, lean on that finger because some meridian field is going to kick into play, and that's going to alleviate depression. Well, that person's still got to go home to a highly autistic child, or
yes,
or having to pay the bills, or an abusive husband or wife, or, and yet, what they then do is they then say, well, look, we're going to change the metrics. It was a success because they were happy when they left here.
But then we'll find something, and this is the thing that may come as it can be quite mystifying. Even the worst therapists on the planet get raving reviews.
Yeah.
Even homeopaths are delivering nothing more than placebo. However, the placebo is the excuse for some highly detailed interactions between the homeopath, who's probably a very, very caring individual, and the recipient. And I'm sure there's going to be, amongst a handful of listeners here, somebody going to say, but homeopathy's proven to be written. No, it's not. There is no such thing as efficacy within homeopathy. But we do have a whole field built around placebo. But there's more going on. So even though the actual remedy in the little bottle, which is highly overpriced because it's just rubbish, there's nothing in it. There is something in the interaction. And there are plenty of homeopathic devotees who say it's cured their condition and healed, changed their life. And this is one of the problems, because even the worst therapist or the therapist who has nothing to offer, like in homeopathy, get rave reviews. Mm. Kevin has reams of fans who think he is amazing. And I was, because of the webpage, because if you type his name, for those listening, type Kevin Lay into Google, my page comes up at number 2. Now, because of that, I get a lot of Kevin Lay's fans contact me, and a lot of his clients, former clients, have contacted me, and people think he's amazing. So now we have to be realistic that whilst you and I can look at him as men looking at him, because guys know guys, women know women, we can see through a lot of stuff. The reality is what he does work. and has worked, and he has got some really good results for people, as is evidenced. You'll see some of those newspaper interviews with some of the celebrities he's worked with. They're real. Those people really benefited from meeting him. And so we, again, when we take a critical view, we have to look at it from that sort of adversarial perspective that I was referring to before, because there's more than one side to what's going on. The picture is so complex. It is so nuanced. It's very hard to nail it down to a single thing, which is the one sentence headline explanation.
I think that word nuance has come up time and time again with the few people that I've interviewed for the podcast so far. You know, that word nuance is key. Especially as we're dealing with, how do I put this politely? Some low-level intelligence, literal people. And it almost feels like nuance just doesn't exist.
Yeah. But we don't educate young people to be critical. We don't train people to be critical thinking. We don't train people to have more than one view. Social media, and look, how many hours do people spend looking at a screen, whether it's a telephone screen, how many hours a day is the average person? A lot. And it's a huge amount. And there was a time where you had to sit down in front of a TV screen and wait for the show to come on. Now we've solved the problem of boredom for everybody in the form of a smartphone in the pocket, or a tablet or a computer. The social media platforms that people interact with curate very carefully the algorithm to tailor to keep eyeballs on the screen at all times. So now people go into these reality tunnels, these echo chambers of the social media. And so people's tolerance of counterviews, people's tolerance or exposure even to counterviews is reduced. So now when somebody encounters something that they don't agree with or is unfamiliar to them, they don't, that's not normal anymore. That is the black swan. That's the anomaly. That's the thing that stands out. Oh my God, this person's got a different view. But there was a time where the only interaction we had, apart from sitting down waiting for our show to come on the TV, we had to actually talk to real human beings. And in the social interactions with real human beings, of course, we're constantly being exposed to all the contrary views. We all knew, here's the thing, I think this comes from Abigail Shreya. When we were children, we knew the other kids who we would hang out with and play with, but we also knew their parents, and we knew what all those kids' parents did for a living. We knew some of their political ideations. You knew the dad who was the bad-tempered, miserable old fucker. You knew the mum who would always make you marmalade sandwiches. We knew those things about people. What's interesting now is surveys of young people, the majority of teenagers do not know what the parents of their friends do for a living. And that is because most of the social interactions they're having is not in real space, in living rooms, in bedrooms, in the kitchens. Now it's taking place through platforms. It's through screen mediums where now the data is highly curated. And so we're training people now to not be able to cope with contrary views. And this is also true for coaches and therapists. Because even though, say, a lot of coaches and therapists may be of our age, their awareness, their thinking, their attention spans have also been trained. The amount of book reading that adults our age have used to engage in compared to now we have social media is incredible. It has reduced tremendously. People don't read books anymore. People don't study anymore. The attention span is reduced to such a tiny, tiny fraction of what it used to be. Adults have now been rendered into the same psychology as the teenagers. And this carries a cost. This carries a cost. People are living out their lives on their social media platforms as opposed to in the real world.
And yet there must be more to it than that, because you don't need to physically have a book in your hand to read a book now. You can have it entering your ear holes through Audible or this and that, which I do. You know, I'm always listening, walking the dogs, driving the car. Sometimes I'll be belting out Queen, but most of the times I'll have Audible on and I'll be listening to something. But yet there's no... Do you know what? Maybe it's that thing that there is no pressure or need to be smart anymore.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in fact, we see it played out in society where Gemma Collins can be worth £5 million. what's her name with the big boobs, Jordan or whatever her name is, can be worth millions even though she's bankrupt five times over. And stupidity is rewarded.
Yes.
Shallowness is rewarded. I mean, I say to my kids, don't have kids. Go see the world. It's because the future's
And
bleak, I
there's an
think.
epidemic of cosmetically enhanced teenagers now as well,
Yeah.
who are having the lip fillers done.
They all look
They're
the same.
waiting to, they're waiting to get old enough to have boob jobs or whatever, and vaginoplasty. I mean, it's incredible now. Just the amount we've chemically adjusted childhood for decades now. We've therapized and pathologized childhood in every possible way, and now it's in the community. It's in the society. It's in the cultural paradigm. It's in the lexicon, and so now kids are doing it to themselves. There used to be a point when, say, psychiatry was imposing diagnostic frameworks on young people. And that was the stuff I used to oppose. There was a group, for those unfamiliar, the Radical Therapist Collective. The Radical Therapist Collective. Have a look. Radical Therapy Collective, Radical Therapist Collective. The group's not around anymore. And this was a group that was a largely liberal, left-wing progressive, who opposed psychiatry, which was the agent of the state. Psychiatry was basically a system of control of the state, where your mental health was an aberration enough. You would be locked up and medicated. And so the Radical Therapist Collective basically fought against that ethos. Now, what's happened is the population is diagnosing itself. And psychiatry is now going, guys, no, you don't all have ADHD. No, you're not all neurodivergent. No, you're not all autistic. The role reversal has taken place quite dramatically. And now people oppose psychiatry for a completely different reason. I'm fighting to get my diag. I'm 54. I've been fighting for 10 years to get my ADHD diagnosis because no one would give it to me. And finally, I've got it. This is the mindset we're now seeing, where people are now demanding a diagnosis and they're now displaying it alongside their qualifications. It's almost like Andrew T. Austin, MSc, BSc, PhD, neurodivergent, ADHD/ADD, he, him. You see that kind of shit going on. Where these things now qualifications. So we're now rewarding not just stupidity, we're rewarding madness.
Yeah, and it's at every level in society. I'll give you an example. My daughter, right? She's intelligent, lazy little mare, but she's intelligent. And she probably of the three kids got more in has been getting more in trouble. She's the youngest anyway, but she's been getting more in trouble at school than the others. But she also goes to a crappier school, right? And she's in classes where half the time they're supply teachers. And I don't think she's being challenged. She's bored, right? But because she's had X amount of detentions, all for low-level crap as well, we're talking about not the detentions we would have got when we were at school. That they then tried to push the local NHS trust got involved and contacted us for an ADHD assessment,
Yeah, of course.
and I basically said, "Fuck off." How have you considered it's the quality of your classroom? And also, can you tell me, and I think I had to ask for freedom of information request or this and the other, how much the school gains by having
Yes.
kids that tick boxes? And then what happened is she then started doing her GCSE. So now she's focused, and now the dynamic of the class becomes different. She's not getting detentions anymore. And yet, for the first 6 months, they're still trying to push this assessment. And I replied, why?
Now, what you see
The
now, we have
symptoms have
additional stuff.
gone.
Yeah, but there's additional forces at play here in that the school staff themselves are under pressure to make referrals. And every child matters. Now, again, these slogans, like Black Lives Matter, every child matters, no child left behind, these slogans all sound very positive and coming from a good place. But unfortunately, what starts to happen is when we say every child matters, no child left behind, we immediately, while saying, all children are equal. We're measuring them constantly and putting them in a hierarchy. And the kid who measures with the lowest variables or whatever's being measured is the one who's now seen to be the most vulnerable. Now, you could take a class of absolute fucking geniuses who have been raised by the Archangel Gabriel. And if you do that to them, there's always going to be a child at the bottom. And that's the child we now make the referral for. It doesn't matter. The moment we do that, there's always going to be someone at the bottom of the pile who makes the referral. But it doesn't matter where they're at in terms of the overall well-being hierarchies. So now teachers are under pressure because there's all the liabilities, there's all the insurance issues, there's all the professional standards issues, there's all the inspectorate issues. The teachers are now under massive pressure that the slightest hint that there's a problem, they might be accountable for. And just like every therapist is frightened, yes, but what if they kill themselves? Every teacher has the, what if they're being abused? What if there's self-harm issues? What if there are, and the favorite fucking word of the educational system, safeguarding issues? The pressure's there all under now. They are no longer just people teaching fucking maths, people teaching English. They're no longer teachers. Their roles, their identities have now been turned by the machinations of the system into what they have now become. And then that in turn feeds a paradigm. So the complexities of what's going on are insane. I don't have kids, but all I can say is this. There is no way I would ever send them to school. No way.
Yeah,
I've seen too much of what goes on. I've worked with too many families.
Yeah, funnily enough, it is something that the book Bad Therapy touches on. Well, I mean, that's actually the crux of the book, right? But if you draw the comparison to the therapy, I think you can understand why some of the teachers do it, because they'll alienate themselves now if they don't, because it's
right,
the
they
machine,
have to. Yeah, yeah.
Right? And then you can draw the exact parallel with the therapist. Again, it's that conformity that it doesn't pay to put your hand up and say this isn't right.
That's right.
Yeah, and we see it now. We play it, and the problem is, there's always victims if you don't. And you know, whether it's a child grooming thing or a bad therapist or this that and the other, there's someone at the end is paying a price, and it's the wrong person who shouldn't be paying the price. There are real victims as a consequence for people not speaking out. And this is where I've got to with, you know, let's just make it about hypnotists at this point. I still don't know now in my head whether it would be better if they made it illegal to call yourself a hypnotist rather than allow what is going on in the current state of training. Because it is a money making venture, and somewhere along the lines the people have just got lost along the ones that you're supposed to be doing it for. It's like social services, right? That, you know, the people they're protecting kind of become secondary.
There's another component here, and whilst the dysregulated services are an absolute shit show, can't pretend otherwise. I don't believe regulation will improve it. Because now you have to look at who are going to be the regulators.
Yeah.
The National Council, the British Association, there's all these groups, because obviously they know if they can be the regulators, oh my God, the money they have, the power they then have is enormous. The regulators themselves, now I've been part of regulated professions. I've seen regulated professions. Whilst that sounds very, very reassuring to the public, when you actually see what goes on behind the scenes, it's not quite as good as people would like it to be. So if we were to bring in regulation of, say, hypnosis, hypnotherapy generically, I think things would actually be a lot worse. Because now what's going to happen is the more narcissistic individuals, of which they are numerous, basically the more famous they're likely to be, the more well-known they are, the more likely they are to be narcissistic. Not guaranteed, but very, very likely. Mm-hmm. They're the people who are most likely to end up the regulators. But more importantly, they know how to play the game and they're willing to play it. Someone like me under regulation, how long do you think before they take the license away? Probably within a week of me opening my big mouth and being critical. And that's how regulation works. You play the game and go along with everything, like teachers have to, like the people doing gender-affirming care have to. If they play the game, they get rewarded. You speak out, you're unemployed. And that's one of the unfortunate aspects of regulation, is it's not quite as good as the public would like it to be. And I don't see any way around it at all. I know a lot of, I've spent a lot of time with doctors. I know a lot of doctors. The medical profession ain't quite as good as it's going to be, as we'd like it to be.
Yeah, I think any profession So listen, we could talk all day, right, about this. I think you and I have such a similar viewpoint. It might come across as a sort of nihilistic look at the
Very.
world, especially as therapy. And yeah, and maybe it is. Maybe we'd have to have another podcast to continue this, because there's so
Be
much
delighted to.
I wanted to ask you too about the IEMT and comparisons with EMDR, which I know they literally are chalk and cheese, but up from the outsider looking in, they might not understand it. I wanted to talk about metaphors and movement. I know we're really short of time. Is there anywhere where you'd like to direct people to look at your work? I would urge anyone to join your YouTube page and definitely read the blogs on 23
For
NLP.
the yeah, for the 2 or 3 people that made it this far, and I do thank you, people, you good people, for listening this far.
Thanks, Mum.
Find me on YouTube. If you want more rants and angry Andy and ranty rant and rant ranty Randy, ranty Andy, I've got lots of rants on YouTube about every subject I can think of. Just type my name, Andrew T. Austin, into YouTube. You'll find the channel. I'm SEO'd to the hilt, so to find me, rather than try and remember the domain names, just type Andrew T. Austin into Google, and you'll find the science there. You'll also find the haters, the people who hate me, and there's quite a few out there, and some of them have a point. I won't deny it. And so do enjoy reading the other stuff as well.
Listen, I really will urge people to do that. I think the profession is severely lacking in people with integrity, people who are open to question themselves, who objectivity is a habit, and not an exception. So I just want to say a huge thank you, Andrew. Can I ask you if we can come on again and talk about
I'd be
IEMT
delighted to, Nick. Thank you
and
for having
metaphors
me.
of
So I would be
movement? It's
delighted.
been absolutely fantastic. It's music to my ears whenever I read your blogs or listen to you. And the final point is, you do it because you care.
I
Not,
think so.
yeah, I absolutely know so. Even if it feels like it's just an angry outburst sometimes, you're angry because there's just rules being broken that shouldn't be broken, and that's why you do it. And long may you continue. So
Thank you, Nick.
thank you ever so much, my friend. It's been fantastic.
Welcome.
Thank you for listening to the Hypnosis Discussion Network podcast. Links and additional information for all of our guests can be found on the website www.hypnosisdiscussionnetwork.com. All views and opinions expressed by our guests are their own. Until next time.